Welcome to the Bungie Line yet again. My name is Ted Hager.
I'm Alex Barnett. What?
What do you mean, what?
What are you looking at me? You're doing the intro.
You're inserting dead air into our podcast. I usually kick it off and then you say something next.
That, I'm still thinking about that Bungie sound didgeridoo-dah thing.
You can't get off that one. Every episode, it's our signature sound, it's the didgeridoo. There's actually a story behind the didgeridoo sound.
Go on.
Well, apparently, when we first brought that in, we wanted to get a sound that kind of sounded like Bungie. I told you before, it was Bungie kind of thing.
Bungie.
Yeah, and then we didn't actually have a didgeridoo here, but we did have one of our employees works in documentation. His 18-year-old son is actually able to play a didgeridoo, but we didn't have one. So he took a cardboard tube, and he played a fake didgeridoo. He played a cardboard tube to get the didgeridoo sound that we have there.
That's actually pretty amazing. Can you play it, Ben? And just listen to that. So this is a cardboard tube that we're listening to, not a real didgeridoo.
Not a real didgeridoo.
Okay, let's just listen
to that. We're a startup. We're getting poverty.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, here we go. That's pretty cool. Now, I've got a cardboard box next to me. It's not a cardboard tube. And I'm going to see what kind of noise I can make with that. Just hold on, listen. What do you think?
Coming up on this episode, we're going to have Jeff Barr, our web services evangelist from Amazon.com. So we're going to check out what he has to say about the various web services that Amazon offers. We're going to find out a little bit about the mythical web API service level agreement and whether it actually may exist. We've got quite a few different things coming up in the show. What else?
We're going to be covering the business of APIs. You came back from a conference there where folks are actually discussing what it means to be able to provide APIs, build a developer community. That's kind of interesting. He talks through things like the Elastic Computing Cloud, some news there, flexible payment service, and micropayments. And he covers a lot of ground on this. It's fairly dense. It's good stuff.
And we're going to break this one into two different episodes again, because just like we did with the Jeremy Zawadny interview.
Part one and part two.
Part one and part two. So let's get on with part one. And on the phone with us, we have Jeff Barr from Amazon. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm doing great today. How you guys doing?
We're good, Jeff. Thanks for joining us. Now, you're fairly well known on the old web API and evangelism circuit and Web 2.0 conference circuit. You do a lot of presentations. I've seen a number of them. I think your announcement of Mechanical Turk some years ago back in Seattle. But for the benefit of guys who may not know who you are, maybe you can give a little background on what you've been doing and how you got to Amazon.
Sure, that's a good place to start. So let's say I've been writing code for a living since I was a teenager, and there's way too many years between then and now to go into in detail. So right before Amazon, I spent some time at Microsoft. And at Microsoft, actually, I was working on some very early web services work, some of the first things like that used to be called discovery files that made it possible for applications or for tools to really find web services being exported. Spent about 3 years at Microsoft and then went and spent some time working with some venture capitalists. And in that role, I was actually doing a lot of investigation of early web services companies. And we'd go out and we'd look at these companies, and they typically had applications and tools that would be able to take advantage of web services if only they actually existed. Because at this point, this was around 2000, 2001, and the typical web service you could find was some kind of a demo. It could give you a stock quote if you gave it a stock symbol, or weather if you gave it a zip code. As a technician, you could kind of imagine all the bits flowing back and forth. But from the user point of view, they'd kind of look at that and they'd shrug and say, wow, that's not all that exciting. You know, all these bits and all these moving parts, and you told me what the weather was.
Are you talking about companies, those early companies like the Silver Streams and things like that? Are you talking about larger companies like the PEAs? Or what kind of companies are you talking about?
This was just all over the map. I don't even remember specific names, but it was really back around 2000, 2001, just really selling the concept of web services was actually very, very difficult because there weren't any good examples. So in 2002, I remember logging into my Amazon Associates account one day, and this little box popped up on the side, and it said, Amazon now has XML. And based on all the work I'd been doing, I thought, wow, I really know what XML is all about. So I clicked through on that box and read all about it and had some great ideas for what was there and emailed those, of course, directly back to Amazon. One thing led to another, and before I knew it, they had invited me to come up to a little tiny pre-release developer conference that they were holding basically around their first Amazon Web Service, which is now what we call the e-commerce service. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I came up to this conference and was just myself and about maybe five or six other developers from around the world. And many Amazon people all the way up the chain, all the way up to Jeff Bezos. And so when I was there and I started listening to what they had to say and looked at all their slides and so forth, I got this just amazing impression of this is where the future's going, and I really, really want to be a part of this future.
You got sucked into their gravitational field.
Exactly. And by the end of that day, I actually turned to the person who had invited me there and told her, I really need to be part of this. Can you somehow get me onto this team? So I did some interviews, and before I knew it, I was hired onto the Amazon Associates team, but they asked me if I could also spend what I would think back, kind of ironically, they said, put a little bit of your time helping out those web service guys.
Now, you were living in Seattle at the time, so...
I already was in Seattle.
Yeah, so that works out pretty well.
Describe your role, if you would. What are you doing there?
I have actually, I think, maybe the most interesting job in the world. So I am called the Web Services Evangelist, and in that role, I have a couple different functions. So the kind of the obvious function is to go out and to talk a lot. So I go out to large-scale conferences, I go to user groups for various technologies, and I also meet with individual developers on a more one-on-one kind of a basis. So kind of the obvious part of the job is to do a lot of talking. But another really great part of it, and this has really evolved a lot over time into something that I think is really valuable, is that myself and my team also get to do a lot of listening. So we go out, we speak to these developers, and we hear what they're doing. We get a better understanding of how they're using our services, and we get a whole bunch of great feedback of what we could be doing differently or better. And every day we take that feedback, we write it up into our daily trip reports, we send it right back to our team, and we also send it to the leads of any services that might have been mentioned during the day. So we create this direct feedback channel into the company.
And here we are in 2007, so things have moved a long way in those last 6 years from the time that you've met Amazon in the first place. And, for example, representing Amazon at a conference that you were at yesterday, Business of APIs conference. Tell me, how did that go? What was that about?
So this was a really fun conference. So basically, this was organized by a company called Mashery that has a really neat program that helps companies to really expose and to monitor and to measure the use of APIs. The whole concept of Business of APIs was that it was time for the industry at large to really recognize the fact that sites which provide APIs are in existence, and that if you are a new site, you both need to be providing APIs so that you can have a downstream developer community, and you need to look at all the other APIs that are there and really take a hard look at them and decide, is this something that we should be using as part of our own business? So kind of a wake-up call on both sides, both as the producer and the consumer of web services.
It's really starting to set that culture then. It's just beginning that it's one of the things you have to do. At one point, there was the all companies would have to have websites, and it sounds like more and more companies are starting to realize that now they also have to have a presence in the API department as well.
That's right. When you look at the power that you can expose to developers via APIs, and you can just give them this gigantic running start versus having to build everything from scratch, if you're offering these APIs, you open yourself up to the point where you can create this downstream developer community of people that are taking your basic offering and then building around it. And if you do everything right, they're going to like you. They're going to be essentially part of your own outreach effort, because every time they talk about what they do, they'll probably mention your name as well.
And there would have been companies there, were there... yesterday, maybe, that in 2001, had you asked them, do you think that you're going to have some kind of a developer relations organization or program, how many of them do you think, oh yeah, totally?
I think most of them would have said either what are developers, or we don't trust other people with our information, or we want full control of what happens once these bits leave our firewall.
Yeah.
So there's finally a good recognition that these developers are really an integral part of the ecosystem you would build around a website.
That albatross of control is one of those things that just seems to hang people up. And it's an interesting thing because, I mean, there's I think it was a long time ago that Bill Joy from Sun said something to the effect of, Your organization's not going to have all the good ideas inside. How are you going to take advantage of all those good ideas on the outside? And that's pretty much...
You know, that's totally right.
Yeah.
I was actually on the way, the plane last night, I was reading a book called Wikinomics, and it was very, very much the same concept, that most of the smart people are going to be outside of your organization, not inside.
So if you would, then, Amazon has web services, and we want you to give us maybe a quick tour of the web services, what you guys offer and why developers might want to use what you guys have to offer. And, you know, I was wondering if maybe we could kick that off, if you happen to have any kind of statistical knowledge at all on how much revenue is flowing through Amazon APIs. Do you have any kind of insight? Are you even allowed to tell us that kind of thing?
I don't actually have that insight at all. I know that we definitely measure it and track it very, very closely internally, and the numbers definitely are heading in the right direction for us. But at this point, we don't actually break that out separately.
So can developers
really happy with the way things are going, though.
So can developers actually tap into Amazon APIs and make money off of them?
They can in a couple different ways. So in the most direct route, if they're using something like the Amazon e-commerce service, which is access to our product catalog, they can take catalog data, and from there they can put that on their own website through browsing tools and shopping tools. And as part of building their application, they would also sign up for the Amazon Associates program. When they sign up, we give them a little identifier called an associate ID. They embed that ID in all the calls that they make to the e-commerce service, and then automatically any sales that result from that data that flowed out to the developer's site through those calls will automatically qualify them for commission payments based on the sales that take place. So that's kind of the most direct money-making opportunity. All the other services would be used as part of a larger business. So, for example, if they were building their own business using, for example, the Elastic Compute Cloud, and they built a website of some sort, we would be the engine underneath that kind of a site, or they're storing data using a simple storage service.
And I think what we'll do is let's get through a couple more of the kind of APIs that you have and things, but we do want to come back to the EC2, the Elastic Compute Cloud, and find out a little bit more information about exactly what that is. But take us through more of the APIs, if you would. What other kind of offerings you guys have? I think you guys have recently introduced a flexible payment service, correct?
That's right. We have a really wide variety of different APIs. The first one that we ever introduced was called the e-commerce service. And this was when developers are kind of new to Amazon Web Services and they start thinking, what could Amazon have to offer to me as a developer? This is kind of the most obvious thing that they start to think about. So the e-commerce service, we rolled this one out in 2002. And this is very rich, very sophisticated access to the Amazon product catalog. Developers can use a number of different query APIs to search through the catalog. They can search by product name or by category or by the segment of the catalog, by publisher, by title, by keyword. And then as a result of these searches, they get back very, very rich, very, very detailed data from the catalog. So everything from a product name to description to three different sizes of images to pricing from Amazon and pricing from third-party merchants, reviews, package size, weight,
so you're saying
many different details.
You say reviews on that. So that also exposes then a lot of the social aspects that you guys have? Because, I mean, Amazon, besides being a place where you can buy stuff, has so much stuff like the customer reviews and those kind of things that are much more of a social networking things. And you guys were way out ahead, I think, of most sites, besides things maybe like a Netflix or something like that. You guys were some of the pioneers in really putting that social side to the commerce side. Those are things that are exposed to the APIs as well?
That's exactly right. So the entire full text of all the reviews associated with every product is available through the e-commerce service. And we also link back from that data. We give you not just the review itself, but we give you the customer ID of the reviewer. We give you some usability information of how many people found the review useful, the rating of the review, all the metadata around the review text, essentially.
Very cool.
Now, Jeff, talk to us a little bit about Mechanical Turk, because I remember being in, I mentioned this earlier, in Seattle, where you talked about Mechanical Turk as this interesting concept and service that you were announcing, essentially. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Okay, so the Mechanical Turk is essentially a marketplace for work that needs some kind of human intelligence. Essentially, a good way to think about it is we've got this API where companies can call into the Mechanical Turk. They can load in these pieces of work that are called HITs, or human intelligence tasks, and then those hits are loaded up and they're protected by something called a qualification. There's essentially a rule that controls who's allowed to do the work, and then they're attached to payment information. So from there, anybody around the world can find these pieces of work. They can do any necessary qualifications. So, for example, if the work involved was to read French and translate that to English, you'd use a qualification to ensure that your workers could, in fact, read French and write English. The workers do the work, and they return it to the system. The requesting organization has the ability to do statistical quality control on the results. And then the requesters get their finished work. The workers get paid. So we create this marketplace for all different types of human-powered applications. So sorting, filtering, processing images, looking at a large number of submissions to a website to make sure that they fit some kind of a rule, combing through images. We actually had a project underway where we're trying to help find Steve Fawcett's plane that went down somewhere in Las Vegas. We had thousands and thousands of satellite images and many people combing through them to look for clues as to where that plane might be.
And there was the Microsoft chap as well, where you teamed up with Google and a couple of other companies doing similar thing for a boat that went missing, right?
That's right. That was the Find Jim Gray experience.
Right.
So in both these cases, it really shows you the fact that with a combination of the Mechanical Turk, and then we have the satellite imagery, we worked together with Google to get that loaded. A lot of people simply chipped in and said, let's just go and see what we can do to help in this very, very large search effort.
No, well, that was an amazing story.
I don't even have the number offhand, but lots and lots of people were pouring through those images.
Yeah.
And,
I was one of them for Jim Gray. Jim Gray,
excellent.
There was a whole bunch of Microsoft employees that were trying to do what they could from their PC, and it's kind of sense that you were somehow contributing to this massively distributed effort by a whole bunch of people from around the planet trying to find a guy like Jim. And other kind of uses, we've used it here at Bungie, actually Mechanical Turk, for doing usability testing on our website, for example. We put up a whole bunch of tasks to a URL and recruited people with time on their hands who were just going to try out these various different specific tasks, you know, find the sign-up button, find this part of the page, do this. And we got a lot of feedback that would have taken a lot more cost, a lot more time to be able to get that volume of quality feedback back on a simple thing like usability testing of a website.
And it's staggering to see what kind of quality people actually take the time to type things in. They feel like this responsibility, like they don't just click the checkbox. They'll put in the extra feedback. Are there APIs into Mechanical Turk data so you can pull things out, make your own kind of reports, or make your own kind of whatever app you need to out of some of it?
So there are APIs that you would use as the requester to load in your work into the system and then to get the finished work back out from there. There aren't any APIs that really go globally across the different results because those results are the property of the organization that paid to have them generated.
So back to the EC2, you made an announcement today, Jeff, relating to the Elastic Computing Cloud.
That's right. We've actually expanded the scope of the EC2 beta. We've announced that it's an unlimited beta, so as many developers as like are now open to sign up. And we also expanded the range of what are called instance types. So the instance type is essentially a profile of the type of virtual environment that you get. And so the original instance type was called small, and the small instance type, you had about 1.7 gigabytes of memory and a single virtual processor and 160 gigabytes of disk storage on a 32-bit machine. We've actually now got large instances and extra large instances that are either 4 or 8 times the size of the original. So the extra large instance is actually 15 gigabytes of memory, 8 compute units, which are basically 4 virtual cores, and then 1.7 terabytes of local storage on a 64-bit machine. So
nice.
Any developer that needs that heavy horsepower machine can get one of those at a princely sum of 80 cents per hour.
Wow. Let's back up just a second. Maybe just explain real quick, what is EC2's goal? Who's it supposed to be serving? And how can people take advantage of it?
The idea with EC2 is that it's essentially processing on demand. And the on-demand model actually really permeates a lot of the different services that we provide. So the old model, if you will, was really that you'd have to go and you'd sign up in advance for a certain amount of processing or storage or bandwidth. And regardless of whether you guessed high or guessed low, you had to pay for whatever you committed to. With our on-demand model that we call web-scale computing, you simply use what you need and you pay for exactly what you use. and that works both for processing and for storage and for message queuing. So EC2 is the processing aspect of that. The idea is you get a virtual hosted environment. You use a data structure called Amazon Machine Image, which is essentially your boot disk to load up your operating system and your application. You start these up either with a command line tools or a Firefox UI or APIs, where you simply say, run instances. So you make a web service call to the EC2 cloud. You tell it how many copies of this machine image you'd like to have running. And it, after a very, very short setup time, on the order of about 2 minutes, you actually will then get a list of all the domain names that have been assigned to your running instances. So they each boot the copy of your machine image, and they're, at this point, we have various different types of machine images that we've built and a number of great third-party images built by our development community. There are things like you'll take a raw copy of Linux. They'll then put an entire LAMP stack on there. They'll put vertical applications. They'll do things like the Hadoop parallel processing system or MPI Blast for doing gene sequencing. So these things are now available as processing building blocks. You want to do gene sequencing, you don't need to start by building a supercomputer. You can simply sign up for an EC2 account and spin up a whole bunch of these instances, and you're off and running.
So the fascinating thing I think about that is this can be for a big organization that just needs to have this scale out, but it could also be for the group of guys who are just trying to do their startup, trying to get it off the ground and don't want to have to invest in their own data center. Is that correct?
That's correct. And quite often I'll meet developers that they're in this classic spot that I kind of draw the same picture over and over again. They're at the one user, one processor kind of state of their graph, but their goal is many, many users, many processors. And they kind of see in their head there's a line between where they are and where they'd like to be, but there's this big mystery cloud right there in the middle. But they're not quite sure what's supposed to happen. How are they ever going to get this very, very large-scale data center? Where are they going to get bandwidth? Where are they going to figure out how to pay for all these things? They never know how much they need. They never know how they're going to get there. And I think we take away a lot of the risk and the mystery out of doing one of those kind of startups, where I've talked to many developers that had grandiose ideas, but they simply said, what do I do if it suddenly gets successful? How do I grow? How do I scale?
So maybe give us an idea of the usage of this, if you know any stats on it, like how many virtual machines are going on at this time, or how much data storage, any kind of thing like that. Just give people an idea of the scale of this thing at this point.
I don't actually have any metrics. This is still in beta, and we haven't quite figured out the right metric to support in a number that would be helpful to our community.
Eventually, Jeff, I will ask a question where I say, give me a metric on this, and you will say, it's this.
Yeah, he's got it. It's 64 bits.
Yeah.
Right? That's a lot of horsepower you've added there this morning.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Was that just
The response just this morning from developers has been great. I was actually reading early comments on the AWS blog, and the response has just been really, really, really awesome to read what people have to say.
Is that just getting out ahead of it then, making sure that you have it in place, or was that driven by demand from people saying, hey, we're going to need this kind of architecture?
I would say it was definitely part of the plan to offer a variety, but at the same time, as we go out and we talk to developers, we do get this great feedback that lets us really fine-tune the kinds of things that they're looking for.
And do you have an example?
It's really neat to be able to go back to developers later and say, in large part because we heard from you, these are the things that we have actually introduced.
Have you come across an unexpected use of applications or websites you can talk about where you think, wow, that's really cool. I really didn't think somebody would be using for that or are using it successfully to grow their business?
Well, let's see. I was at Business of APIs yesterday. I heard from someone who said that their new application, which I can't talk about, they said that they're actually using 5 different Amazon services altogether. So this is a really interesting trend that we're seeing, is that they look at one service and they say, this is kind of interesting, and then they look at the next and say, wow, if I put these two together, that's even better. And this person who's not ready to roll out said he's got 5 different services in use. And one of the ways that we actually enable and encourage that architecture model is we don't actually measure or charge for bandwidth between different Amazon services. So if you've got a whole bunch of data stored in Amazon S3, you can pull it over to your compute cloud, process it, and store it back. And that bandwidth going back and forth is not charged.
That's nice. And what about the API designs? Are you targeting commonality and common design patterns across the APIs that you're providing for example, those 5 services?
So we do have a set of internal design rules that each team, as the service teams actually come up with potential new services, we actually give them a set of rules and say, this is what you need to follow in order to debut an API. It's a very, very tough challenge because you want to leave them a little bit of room for innovation because sometimes there's a good reason why they don't need to go with every last possible rule. But at the same time, we want to make things very, very developer-friendly so that hopefully once you've learned things in one service, you can apply them to the others.
And there's S3 and the SLA announcement that you made last week. You guys have been busy on your blog the last few days. So what's that all about?
Okay, so the S3 service level agreement basically is a set of terms that really, it tells developers essentially what to expect performance-wise from us, and it also says if we don't meet a certain level of uptime, what kind of credit will they get back from us? So it gives them the ability to really trust what we're doing because they know that if we don't meet our expectations and our design goals for the service, then it's going to hurt us.
And this is in the storage space,
right? It's in our best interest to keep these things running.
Yeah, and this is just give a quick outline, Jeff, on S3.
Okay, so S3 is a shortcut for the Simple Storage Service, and it's essentially an online storage API where developers can push objects to us, and these objects can be anywhere from a single byte on up to 5 gigabytes at a time. And developers can store any amount of data with us that they'd like. We've got individual customers with in excess of 300 terabytes of data stored with us. So very, very large-scale storage.
When you say data storage, though, I mean, there's a lot of different types. There's file storage, there's database storage, and those kind of things. What kind of data storage are we talking about?
A good way to think about this is object storage, because when you read or write to S3, you're always moving entire objects. You simply post an entire block of data to us, or you retrieve that entire block. And then once you store something, it's stored redundantly within multiple different S3 data centers.
So somebody could put a database that they have up there as an object block then? Or
I've seen one use case that's kind of interesting, and I don't have all the details right now, but I've seen what people will do is they will do snapshot backups to S3 of a database.
We spoke with John Mercer of Programmable Web.
I just saw John yesterday.
Oh, okay. You saw him down in for the Business API conference. So he's been on this Bungie line previously, and we touched on SLAs and the whole kind of space of SLAs and APIs and getting his view. And his answer was, well, what SLAs, right? And his view was that it's still very early days in this whole web APIs as a service space. And
I believe he said it's a mythical beast. It'll never happen. You're smoking rope, Alex Barnett.
Yeah,
I think that's what he said.
That's right.
I quote him directly on that.
And there we have S3 SLA coming out, and Amazon leading the way on this. And I think that developers need it, right? They need to know that there's going to be some level of guarantee or at least get compensated back if it's not the case. So I think reading through the terms that you had, that you published last week, they all sounded very fair and sensible.
Do you ever think that you guys might extend that out? Are there other services that might need that same kind of thing?
So I could envision that other services will gain SLAs over time. And this is one of the things that was definitely driven directly by customer requests, where they looked at S3, they said, this sounds really good, and they're trying to architect a bigger solution where they want S3 to be a part of it. And so in order to really know the expectations of how well it will perform, they simply said, we need the SLA. Now, the interesting thing that I'm starting to understand about this whole business of SLAs is that there's a certain group of people that really care a lot about the individual details and rates and credits and so forth. But in other situations, it genuinely is simply a checkbox where they just want to know that we're committed to providing a certain level of service, that the details are not as important to them as simply the fact that, yes, we have made a commitment.
Well, that gets us partway through the interview. This guy's actually very articulate. It's like he really knows what's going on in this stuff. It's amazing how somebody can have, you know, Amazon's got such a breadth of stuff out there, and he's just able to hit topic after topic, except my metrics questions. He's not able to get those.
Yeah, well, he's been there from the beginning, 2001, when Amazon really kicked off its web services activities. So he's been there from the get-go.
So we'll be back with our next episode to finish out the interview with Jeff Barr. And Alex, you know, we've started a little bit of a trend with the show. I think at the end of each show, we've been talking about different web services and websites and things that have become available to us or that we've become aware of, and just sort of sharing kind of what we've done lately. You got anything?
No, but you do, don't you?
Yes, I do. I've got a burning hole in my pocket. It's not really a web APIs thing. I just thought it was really cool. So I'm on a MacBook, and I've got the Google Notifier on there for my Gmail. And the update just came in for that yesterday. And when I got this, it had another app there that I hadn't seen before. I don't know how long it's been around. I didn't look into how long it's been around. This might be old news to some people. But they've got a tool called SketchUp, Google SketchUp. And this thing absolutely rocks. Now, I just finished redoing my bedroom where I painted the walls and everything else.
What color?
Well, let's not get into the color because it really didn't come out the way I wanted it to. But the point really actually being, or the point that I want it to be, is this tool SketchUp actually allows you to do line drawings, perspective drawings and things, and just really quickly manipulate things like walls and everything. So I actually managed to sketch up my entire bedroom, all the different walls, just measuring it out. Okay, it's about this long, bang, and putting in all the angles and things. So now I actually have like this drafter's type image that I can rotate around and look at the bedroom and things. I've put like the mirror on the wall. I'll be putting the rest of the furniture in there. And what's really cool about it is now I can actually like put this online, use it through Google Earth and things like that.
Nice.
And so, yeah, it's really sweet for that. But one of my biggest problems is if I don't have the measurements for things like the bedroom and stuff like that, and I'll see a piece of furniture or maybe a piece of art that I want, I wonder if it would go on that wall. And I get home and it's like tiny on the wall or it's huge on the wall or whatever. This will allow me to have like a way of just having virtual representation of it. I can look it up when I need to. So if I'm at Home Depot or whatever, I can get that.
And how's it spelled?
How's it spelled? SketchUp, I think. SketchUp.
Okay, so if they type in that into Google, they'll find it.
Yeah, and it works on my MacBook. I'm sure probably they must have a Windows version as well out there. I don't know if they've done a Linux version yet, but yeah. So it's kind of a cool little app.
And you can wipe these things into Google Earth.
Yeah. You can it's actually got a button for Google Earth. And then there's also like they have a whole library online of different objects and things like plants and pots and things like that. So you can like drop things into rooms. But it's not just for doing rooms and stuff like that. It's for doing just about any model. If you're doing like a mini building project and, you know, you're not a CAD person or something like that, this is a cool free app that you can actually just whip together your design plans, put all your, you know, lumber in place and everything and make your plans, go up, buy your stuff, and build to spec.
Because you like building stuff, don't you? You're very handy around the house,
that's
kind of thing.
That is me.
There you go.
And with that, thanks very much for joining us. We'll see you next time.